Knocking on Heaven's Door came up first, followed by Don't Fear the Reaper. I turned it off. I don't know what I did until 3. I think I passed a great deal of time sitting and staring into the fire. Liminal sucks. You can't grasp it with your hands and shape it. You can't make midnight come faster or grow up sooner or avoid the in-betweens. You can only hang in there and get through them. I showered, put on makeup, and sleeked my hair back into a short ponytail. I tugged on black jeans, a t-shirt, a sweater, boots, and a jacket. I grabbed my backpack and stuffed my Mac-Halo in. I was going to be out late. I holstered my spear and my shoulder harness, tucked in 2 of Baron's short-sheathed knives I'd pilfered from an upstairs display case into my waistband, and loaded myself with diced Rhino Boy, jars in my jacket pockets, plastic baggies in my boots. I strapped my Velcro bands with the click-it lights around my ankles and wrists. I even slipped a vial of holy water into the front pocket of my jeans. In this town, you never know what's coming. As they say back home, I was loaded for bear. All kinds. I went downstairs, glanced out the window, and did a double-take, wondering if I'd lost track of time. It had been clear and light in the cold, wintry way of early November when I'd gone upstairs. Now, at 3:45, it was nearly dark outside. A storm had blown in while I'd been blow-drying my hair. It wasn't raining yet, but the wind was kicking up, and it looked like we might get a real ripper any time. I picked up the car keys and glanced around the bookstore to make sure I wasn't forgetting anything. As my gaze swept the 4-story room, I shrugged off a sudden broody fear that I might never see Baron's Books and Baubles again. Like I loved the city, I'd grown to love my store. The hardwood floors gleamed beneath the sconces and cut amber lamps. The books were all shelved in their proper places. The magazine rack was freshly stocked. The fires were off. The sofas and chairs were invitingly positioned in cozy arrangements. The mural above me was lost in shadows. One day I was going to climb up there and see what it was. The store was tidy and quiet, stuffed with fictional worlds to be explored, business ready and waiting for the next customer. I headed for the back door. It would be waiting for me when I got back tomorrow, when the walls were strong, and I had a whole year to figure things out. I would start keeping regular hours again and get to work on my plans to set up a website and catalog the rare editions upstairs. No more slacking. But right now, an Italian stallion was waiting for me, stomping and snorting. Out back, a Ferrari was calling my name. There were 2 hours of road between me and where I was going, and that was one liminal I was going to love every minute of. Chapter 17. I made it 12 blocks. My end of town, next to the dark zone, had been deserted as a war zone. Now I knew why. The streets 1/8 of a mile east of BB&B were so packed with people and unseelie that motor traffic didn't have a hope of getting through. Most of the Fae were in full human glamour, trying to incite riot, and succeeding. Garda pushed among them, demanding order with raised batons. There are enough troubled youth in Dublin, in any city, for that matter, that even a small angry mob can combust and spread like wildfire, especially on Halloween when all the freaks come out, hiding behind better masks. While I watched, a few of the Garda, who were actually unseelie in glamour, began viciously beating a group of youths with their batons, incensing the crowd. Other unseelie began smashing out store windows, looting and encouraging others to take what they wanted. I called out to a few kids hurrying by to join the fracas. No one seemed to know what the rioting was about, nor did they care. I was afraid to get closer for fear of damaging the car, or me. Bile boiled in my stomach from the compressed multitude of Fae. At least the she-sadu wasn't around to incapacitate me. The mob was expanding, pushing outward, and it occurred to me that getting stuck in the middle of it, sitting in a Ferrari, was a really bad idea. I backed up, hastily turned around, and drove away, glad I'd left a few minutes early. I dug out a map of the city from my backpack and flipped on the interior light. Although the storm still only threatened, The cloud cover had turned day to night a full hour earlier than I'd expected. 10 blocks north of the bookstore, I encountered another mob. I backed up, swung the car around, and headed west. It was no go. That way out of town was just as bad. I pulled over in a parking lot to study the map, then headed southwest, intending to skirt the edge of the dark zone on my way out and, if I had to, put on my Mac Halo and drive through part of it to get out of town. But as I approached the perimeter of the abandoned neighborhood, I slammed the brakes and stared. The entire edge of the zone was a dense black wall of shades, pressing at the pools of the light cast by the street lamps on Dorsey Street. It stretched left and right as far as I could see, a massive barricade of death. I put the car in reverse and backed away. I would go through it only if I had to. I wasn't yet ready to admit defeat. I spent the next 15 minutes driving the ever-decreasing circumference of my world, hemmed in by danger on all sides. The edges of the dark zones had met and merged with the mobs, and I watched in horror as unseelie and human glamour drove people into those waiting, killing shadows. It finally occurred to me to get out of the flashy red car that was beginning to attract a dangerous amount of attention, so I sped back to BB&B, where I planned to swap it for something nondescript and figure out how to escape the city. As I turned down the side street leading to the store, I slammed the brake so hard I nearly gave myself whiplash. Baron's Books and Baubles was dark. Completely. It was surrounded by night on all sides. Every exterior light on the bookstore was out. I stared blankly. I'd left them all on. I eased off the brake and inched closer. In the gleam of headlights, glass glittered on the cobbled street. The lights weren't off. Someone had broken them all out, or, considering how high they were mounted, shot them out. Or, someone had sent those flying fey, maybe even hunters, to do the job. Were they perched up there right now on the cornices, looming over me? There were so many fey in the city that my she-sensor felt bombarded, overwhelmed by presences too numerous to count or differentiate. I peered up, but the roof of the store was lost in darkness. Although the interior lights were on, they were set at the subdued after-hours level, and what spilled onto the pavement through the beveled glass door and windows was not enough to deter my enemy. One more city block had fallen to the shades. Mine. Baron's Books and Baubles was part of the dark zone. Would the shade's more substantial brethren enter BB&B tonight, smash it up, break out the interior lights, and render it unsalvageable? Could they? I knew Baron's hadn't warded it against everything, just the bigger risks. My eyes narrowed. This was unacceptable. The Fae would not take my sanctuary. I would not be turned out into the streets. They would get their nasty, shady petunias out of my territory, and they would do it now. I spun in a screech of tires and drove in the other direction. 4 blocks from the dark zone's new perimeter, the mob pushed me back. I floored it in reverse, narrowly missing parked cars, stopping beneath a pool of bright street lamps. I could hear angry shouts, breaking glass, and the thunder of the approaching mob. I would not be swallowed up by it, but I had to act fast. I stepped out of the car, plunged my hand beneath my jacket, and fisted it around my spear. I wasn't losing it this time. A cold, wind-borne mist pricked my face and hands. The storm had begun. But it wasn't just storm I sensed in the air. Something was wrong, terribly wrong, besides angry mobs and hordes of unseelie and shades overtaking my home. The wind was strange, blowing from multiple directions, reeking of sulfur. The fringes of the chaotic, destructive crowd surged around the corner, 2 blocks from where I stood. "Blaine, I need you," I cried, releasing his name. It uncoiled from my tongue and swelled, choking me, then slammed into the back of my teeth, forcing my mouth wide. But instead of soaring into the night sky, it crashed into an invisible wall and plummeted to the pavement, where it lay fluttering weakly, a fallen dark bird. I nudged it with the toe of my boot. It disintegrated. I turned my face to the wind, east and west, north and south. It eddied around me, buffeting me from all sides, slapping me with hundreds of tiny hands, and I suddenly could feel the LM out there, working his dark magic to bring the walls down. It was changing things. I flexed the She-Seer place in my mind, focused, turned inward, seeking, hunting, and for an instant I actually got a flash of him, standing at the edge of a stark, sheer black cliff, in an icy place, red-robed, hands raised. And was that a heart held high, dripping blood? Chanting, summoning arts powerful enough to crash a prison wrought from living strands of the Song of Making. And it was doing something to all magic, even Fae, making it go terribly wrong. I squeezed my inner eyes shut before it got me killed. I was standing in the middle of a street in a rioting Dublin, trapped in the city, alone. Blaine would not be sifting in to save the day. The mob was less than a block away. The marauding frontliners had just noticed my car and were roaring like maddened beasts. Some toted baseball bats, others swung batons taken from fallen Garda. They were going to beat my Ferrari to smithereens. There wasn't time to dig out my cell phone and try to call Barons. They would be on me in seconds. I knew what happened to rich people during riots. I also knew they wouldn't believe I wasn't rich. I wasn't about to get beheaded with the aristocracy just because every now and then I got to drive a nice car that didn't even belong to me. I grabbed my backpack from the car and ran. A block away, another mob approached. I plunged into it and lost myself inside it. It was a horrible, smelly, hot, surging mass of humanity. It was rage unstoppered, frustration unleashed, envy unsuppressed. It howled with victory as it looted, smashed, and destroyed. I couldn't breathe. I was going to throw up. There were too many people, too many Fae, too much hostility and violence. I swam in a sea of faces, some feral, some excited, others as frightened as I imagined I must look. Fae are monsters, but we humans hold our own. They might have incited this riot, but we were the ones keeping it alive. The cobbled stones were slippery from the misting rain. I watched in horror as a young girl fell, crying out. She was trampled in seconds as the crowd swept on. An elderly man, why on earth was he out here, went down next. A teenage boy was jostled into a street lamp, rebounded, lost his balance, and vanished from view. For time uncounted then, I was driven by a single imperative. Stay on your feet. Stay alive. I rode the crowd, an unwilling mount, feet trapped in the stirrups, from one block to the next. Twice I managed to break free, fight my way to the outer fringes, only to be drowned in the herd again, propelled forward by its relentless stampede. I feared two things, that they would gallop me straight into a dark zone, or that the She-Sadu would make a sudden appearance, and I'd fall to my knees, clutching my head. I couldn't decide which death would be worse. My cell phone was in my backpack, but there wasn't enough room to maneuver in the crowd and get to it. I worried that if I slipped my pack from my shoulders, it would be jerked from my hands and carried off. My spear was cold and heavy under my arm, but I was afraid if I whipped it out, I might be speared by it in the crush. Unseelie. I had baby food jars of it in my pockets. With its dark life in my veins, I would be able to break free of the mob. We were nearing the edge of the Temple Bar district. The dark zone wasn't far. Were we being deliberately driven? If I were able to float above this riot, would I see Unseelie herding us from behind, cattle to the slaughter? Sorry, I muttered. Oops, didn't mean to hit you. Without pissing off anyone badly enough to get myself punched, I managed to extract a jar from my pocket. I had twisted the lids too tight to open them one-handed. I jostled for space and popped the lid. Someone shoved into me, and I lost my hold on it. I felt it hit my boot, and then it was gone. Gritting my teeth, I dug for another one. I had three in my pockets. The rest were sealed in plastic bags tucked inside my boots. I'd never be able to get to them in the crush. I was more careful with this jar, easing it out, clutching it for dear life, which I hoped it was. I had to get out of the crowd. I knew my landmarks. I was two blocks from the dark zone. I managed to pop the lid, but was unwilling to duck my head to eat it, for fear of taking an elbow in the eye, freezing, or stumbling in pain, and going down. I raised the bottle close to my body, tossed my head back, gulped, and chewed. I gagged the entire time I chewed. No matter that I'd been craving it, it was work to get it down, crunchy with gristle and cyst-like sacs that popped when I chewed. It wriggled in my mouth and crawled like spiders in my stomach. When I lowered the jar, I was looking straight into the eyes of a rhino boy, around the heads of two humans, and from the expression on his beady-eyed, bumpy gray face, he knew what I'd just done. He must have seen the pink-gray flesh moving in the jar as I'd tossed it back. I guessed word was getting around between Malouche and the L.M. and O'Banion and now Jane eating them. He bellowed, ducked his head, and charged. I spun and began violently pushing my way through the crowd. I managed to get the third bottle out and gulp that, too, as I fought toward freedom. The only other time I'd eaten unseelie, I'd been mortally wounded and close to death, so I didn't know what to expect. Last time it had taken several large mouthfuls just to begin the healing, and nearly 10 minutes to complete the journey from dying to more alive than I'd ever been. Tonight, I was whole and uninjured. Strength and power slammed into me like I'd taken a needle of adrenaline straight to my heart. A chilly heat suffused me as the potency of Fae spiked my blood. Savage Mac raised her head and looked out through my eyes, fought with my brain, and rearranged my limbs into a sleeker composition. Powerful, predatory, padding on certain paws. Within moments I was free of the crowd, but in the distance I could hear another approaching. The city had gone crazy tonight. I would learn later that Fae and human glamour had broken into houses and businesses all over town, attacked owners and residents, and driven them out into the streets, forcing the riots to begin. I glanced back. It appeared I'd lost the rhino boy in the crush. Or maybe he decided he was more interested in the destruction of an entire mob than measly me. Behind me was the dark zone. Ahead was another mob, its front wave led by rhino boys smashing out street lamps with baseball bats. To my left were sounds of violence. To my right was a pitch-black alley. I slipped off my backpack, dug out my Mac Halo, strapped and buckled it beneath my chin, then hit the clicket lights, one after another, until I blazed like a small beacon. I smacked my wrists and ankles together, lighting up my hands and feet. The mob rushed me in a great wave. I took off down the dark alley. I lost track of time for a while then, racing down streets and alleys, drawing up short, doubling back, trying to avoid the mobs and evade the troops of rhino boys with whom I had repeated close calls, since I could no longer sense them, now that my she-seer senses were deadened by my gruesome meal. They marched militantly, rounding up the stragglers to herd into the mobs. I crisscrossed the same blocks dozens of times, hiding in doorways and dumpsters. I had a terrible moment where I got hemmed in between two groups of them, and was forced to sidle behind cardboard boxes in the shadows of a trash bin and turn off all my lights to let the horde of unseelie crash by. I tasted death sitting there in the darkness, wondering if there were dark spots, really tiny areas where only one or two shades lived, and any moment it might slither from a crack and get me, and the thought was almost worse than flinging myself into the middle of the passing unseelie, which, by the way, I unzipped my baggies and ate some of, sitting there with my knees tucked up in the darkness behind the steel bin. Maybe, as I'd once joked to Barons, shades really didn't like dark meat, and they'd leave me alone. After the troops passed, I crawled out and clicked myself back on. Yes, people were being driven, gathered and herded, lambs to the slaughter, my people. And there wasn't a thing I could do about it. Eating unseelie might have transformed me from a pocket knife into an Uzi and turned me into a walking weapon, but I was still only one weapon and acutely aware of it. I was defense, not offense. There was no offense to be made in this city tonight. Not even Savage Mac, the cockiest of cocky, felt punchy. She felt threatened, feral. She wanted to find a cave to hide in until the odds were more in her favor. I was inclined to agree. Survival was our prime directive. The first time I'd eaten unseelie, nothing had fazed me. But that night, I'd only had to worry about a single rotting vampire, plus I'd had barons by my side. Tonight I was trapped in a rioting city of hundreds of thousands of people. It was Halloween. The Unseelie were numerous and horribly organized. Blaine was unreachable, and Barons was a country away. I finally found myself in a semi-lit deserted alley, with no militant footfalls or sounds of rioting nearby. I ducked into a doorway lit by a single naked overhead bulb to take care of something that badly needed taking care of. I removed my pack carefully, dropped it, ripped off my jacket, and gingerly, delicately removed my spear harness, which I placed on the ground. The entire time I'd been running and hiding, its heavy weight had been a burning terror against my body. What if I fell? What if I got caught in a crowd again and someone jostled me? What if the tip pierced my skin? Hello, Malouche. Goodbye, sanity. I might be tougher than I used to be, but I had no doubts about my ability to cope with rotting to death. I stripped off my sweater and T-shirt, then put my sweater, jacket, and Michaelo back on and belted the spear harness on the outside of my coat without touching anything but the leather straps. I tied the T-shirt I'd removed around the bottom part of the harness, forming an additional layer of protection between the tip and me. Ironic, the thing I love most that makes me feel so powerful under normal circumstances becomes my greatest liability, and the thing I fear most when I pilfer dark power. I can have one or the other, but never both. Carrying the dichotomy one step further, I could no longer sense the spear, which meant I could inadvertently hurt myself on it. However, I could also no longer sense the Shisadu, which meant it could no longer hurt me and send me crashing to my knees, helpless, in a dangerous situation. Duh. I stood in the doorway marveling and not in a good way at my own stupidity. If eating Unseelie made me unable to sense the Shisadu, then all I needed to do next time it popped up on my radar was get as close to it as I could, eat Unseelie, and get closer. Close enough to pick it up. An image of the beast as I'd last seen it materialized in my mind. Yeah, right. Pick it up. Sure. What then? Put it in my pocket? I didn't have one large enough. So I knew how to get close to it without being incapacitated by pain. I still had no idea what to do then. If I touched it, would I, too, turn psycho? Or was I a she-seer, null, oop-detector mutant that was somehow exempt? A moot point right now, with my odds of surviving the night looking so grim. I dug out my cell phone to call Danny and tell her what was happening in Dublin. There was no way I could make it to the Abbey. I glanced at my watch and was stunned to find it was nearly 7 o'clock. I'd been running and hiding for hours. The ritual might already be completed, and if it was, she-seers could come to the city and help me save some of the people being driven to death by shade. I might not be able to make a difference, but 700 of us could. If they couldn't or wouldn't come because Rowena vetoed it for some idiotic reason, I would call Barons. And if he didn't answer, I'd call Riordan. And if neither of them answered, it was probably time for IYD, if you're dying. A pall of death hung over Dublin like grief over a funeral. I could smell it, taste it on the air. If no she-seers were coming in to join me, I wanted out, any way I could get there. Danny answered on the second ring. She sounded hysterical.
Thekmac,
she cried.
What did you do to us?
I'd been adjusting the straps on my pack to accommodate my bulky external harness, and alarm made me drop it. What's wrong? I demanded.
Shades, Mac. Feckin' shades came out of the feckin' orb when we opened it. The Abbey's full of them.
I was so stunned that I nearly dropped the phone. When I got it back to my ear, Danny was saying,
Rowena says you betrayed us. She says you set us up.
My heart constricted. No, Danny, I didn't, I swear. Somebody must have set me up. The thought iced my blood. There was only one person who could have, one person that walked among those dark vampires without fear. How easily he'd relinquished the relic. How quickly he'd agreed to give it to me. Yet he'd not given it to me that night. 30 hours had passed between my request and his delivery. What had he been doing during those hours? Spiking a she-seer's drink with shades? How bad is it? I cried.
We've lost dozens. When we opened the orb, they splintered, and we thought the light from the ritual killed them, but they feckin' grew back together in the shadows. They're everywhere, in closets, in shoes, anywhere there's dark.
Danny, I didn't do this. I swear to you. I swear on my sister. You know what she means to me. You have to believe me. I would never do this, never.
You said you'd come,
she hissed.
You didn't. Where are you?
I'm stuck in the city, holed up between York and Mercer. Dublin's a nightmare, and I couldn't get out. People have been rioting for hours, and the Unseelie are driving them into the dark zones. She sucked in a breath.
How bad is it?
She echoed my question. Thousands, Danny. Beyond counting. If it keeps up like this... I broke off, unable to make myself complete the thought. If you guys come in, we can save some of them, but I can't do it by myself. There's too many Unseelie. But if the Abbey was full of shades, they couldn't leave. We couldn't afford to lose the Abbey. The libraries were there, and God only knew what else. The light bulb above me flickered and made a sizzling noise, as if it had taken a power surge. It's hard to say what makes the brain suddenly piece things together, but I had one of those moments where a series of images flashed through my mind, and I was stupefied by the simplicity and obviousness of what I'd been missing. Rhino boys collecting trash, repairing street lamps, driving city trucks, replacing broken bricks in the pavement. Oh, no, Danny, I breathed, horrified. Forget what I just said. Don't come into the city, and don't let anyone else. Not now, not for any reason, not until after dawn.
Why?
Because they've been planning this. I've been seeing Unseelie in city jobs, and I didn't get it until now. It's not just the street sweepers or the trash collectors. Where better to learn about one's enemy than from the leavings of their life, their refuse? The FBI always infiltrated their suspects' daily lives, bugged their house, and staked out their trash. It's the utility workers, too. How long had the LM been orchestrating his macabre symphony? Long enough to have thought through every bit of it, and his time as a human had taught him well what our weaknesses were. They've got control of the grid, Danny. They're going to turn the entire... I held my phone away from my ear and looked at it. Full battery. No service. The cell phone towers had just gone down. I had no idea how much Danny had heard.
City into a dark zone, I whispered.
The light bulb above me flickered again. I looked up at it. It sizzled, popped, and went dark. Chapter 18. My world was falling apart around me. I was cut off from Blaine. Barons was looking like the ultimate traitor. The Abbey was full of shades. BB&B was a dark zone. The city had fallen to rioters and Unseelie, and it was about to descend into total darkness. Once it did, nothing alive out in the streets would be safe. Nothing. Not even grass and trees. Well, I might be, illuminated by my Mac Halo, armed with my spear, that could kill me horribly at this point. But what if a group of rioters or Unseelie attacked me en masse and rendered me defenseless? What could I hope to accomplish by wandering the city? Could I save lives? What would I do with them if I did? How would I keep them safe when the lights went out? Would they, like drowning people, claw and fight me to death to steal my lights? If I died, who would track the book? I'm no coward, but I'm no fool either. I know when to fight, and I know when to survive to fight another day. Every cell in my body wanted to go up, get off the ground, far from the streets and alleys and lanes that would soon run dark with a flood of shades, closer to the dawn that loomed on what seemed an impossibly far horizon. 12 hours, plus some. I scoured the streets for my Alamo, refusing to ponder the outcome of that battle. I would do better. I finally settled on an old church with a high steeple, an open belfry, and stone archways where I could perch and watch my flanks. The tall double front doors were locked. I liked them that way. There were no windows facing the street. I liked that, too. Here was my fortress, the best I could do, for now, anyway. I circled around the back, kicked in the door of the refectory, and slipped inside. After barricading the door with a heavy china cabinet, I swiped an apple and 2 oranges from a fruit basket on the dining table and hurried through the dimly lit communal areas of the church. It took me a while to find the entrance to the belfry, at the rear of the large chapel, beneath the choir balcony, in the thick of the massive organ pipes. The narrow door was almost completely concealed behind a bookcase that had been shoved in front of it, I suspected, to prevent curious kids from making the climb. I pushed the bookcase aside, an easy nudge as pumped up on Unseelie as I was, and opened the door. It was pitch black beyond. Bracing myself, I stepped inside, lighting up the tower. No shadows recoiled, no inky darknesses slithered. I exhaled with relief. A narrow, rickety wooden stair, more ladder than step, circled 150 feet of stone wall to the belfry. It was actually nailed to the mortar in places. There were neither braces nor suspension for it, and it looked about as safe as a house of cards. I wondered when the last time was that anyone had actually ascended it. Did bells need to be serviced? Or was it more likely that the last time anyone had climbed those stairs was 50 years ago? No matter. I wasn't staying on the ground. The rungs gave out in two places. Both times my heightened strength and reflexes saved me. Without Unseelie hammering through my veins, I would have slipped through the treads, plunged 50 feet, and broken something serious in the fall. Both times I was excruciatingly aware of the cold weight of the spear against my body. I hated having to carry it while I was like this. I was a water balloon with a pin taped to my side, rolling across the floor, tempting fate. Perching precariously on the last rung, I strained to reach the trap door, pushed it up, hoisted myself through, and glanced around. I was in a room directly beneath the spire. Overhead was a second platform similar to the one I was on, above which hung two great brass bells. The room I was in appeared to be a utility room of sorts, with boxes of tools and a broom closet that was partially open. I moved to it, made sure it was shade-free, and closed it. Slightly cracked closet doors give me the creeps. I climbed the final ladder, ascending to the bells. I was surprised to find the storm was far north of the city now. The clouds had broken, and moonlight, though wan, illuminated the belfry. I clicked myself off so I wouldn't be a blazing X marks the spot of nubile young she-seer. 4 tall stone archways, twice as high as my head, framed the spire east, west, north, and south. I stepped into the one facing east and shivered in the cold breeze, staring down at Dublin. Fires burned in many places, and cars lay on their sides in the streets, and thousands upon thousands of rioters raged and looted and destroyed. I watched them ebb and flow up and down city blocks. I watched a group of several thousand driven straight into a dark zone, forced into the waiting wall of pitch, where they were sucked dry of life down to a rind of human remains. I heard their cries of horror. I'll hear them till I die. I stood looking out over Dublin as darkness took the city, grid by grid, district by district, as if somewhere in Dublin's basement circuit breakers were being systematically thrown. I remembered the night I'd curled in my window seat at BB&B, and my eyes had played a trick on me. It was no trick now. Or rather, it was the greatest Halloween trick of all. There would be no treats handed out in Dublin tonight. This was what Derek O'Banion had been talking about. At 8:29 p.m., darkness reigned absolute. Even the fires had been extinguished. The sounds floating up were different now, the voices fewer, and frightened, not angry. Militant footfalls passed beneath me regularly. The Unseelie were still at it, collecting us, killing us. It took every ounce of self-control I possessed to not go down there to hunt in the darkness and try to save those humans that remained. Out there, past a certain bookstore, a dark zone was spreading, unchecked, taking over the city. Dublin was without hope until 7:25 a.m., dawn. I wondered what was happening with the McKelters. Was Baron sabotaging that ritual, too? It made no sense to me. Why would Barons want the walls down? Did Barons want the walls down? Might the orb have come to him already sabotaged, a pre-packaged grenade, just waiting for the pin to be pulled? Where had he gotten it? Was I a hopeless fool, still trying to make excuses for him? Were the walls already down? Was this the flood of Unseelie that had been freed from their prison, the ones wrecking the city? Or were they merely harbingers, and the worst was yet to come? I dropped to the cold stone floor of the aperture, drew up my knees, folded my arms, and rested my chin on them, looking out at the city. My body bristled with the dark energy of unseelie flesh, with the protective urges of a she-seer, magnified by Fae steroids, demanding that I do something, anything. I shuddered in the grip of my internal battle. I felt like I was crying, although no tears fell. I didn't know yet that tears are not possible for a Fae, or for anyone under the influence of it. Seeing B.B. and B. surrounded by shades, swallowed up by a dark zone, had been bad enough. Seeing all of Dublin dark was overload. How many people would be left by dawn to try to reclaim it? Any? Did Unseelie now guard wherever it was the utilities were controlled? Would we have to form armies to fight our way in and seize control from them? My world had changed tonight. I had no idea in how many ways, but I knew it was bad. I sat in the cold stone opening, watching, waiting. 3.5 hours later, the first of my questions was answered. At 11:59, the skin all over my body began to crawl, literally. I scratched myself feverishly. Even deadened as my she-seer senses were from my dark meal, I still felt it coming. No, the walls had not yet fallen. They were falling now. The world was changing, becoming. I felt a crushing sense of spatial distortion, stretching me, twisting, compressing. I was gigantic and paper-thin. I was small and round as a berry. I was inside out, my bones exposed. I was a bag of skin again. Then the world felt suddenly much too large and horrifically skewed. The buildings below soared up at jagged, impossible angles, vanished down to pinpoints, then erupted again. I watched as laws of physics were rewritten, as dimensions that were not meant to coexist crashed into each other and vied for dominance, contested for space to fill. I watched as the fabric of existence was ripped apart and sewn back together again, aligned on diametrically opposing principles. The universe screeched in protest as barriers collapsed and realms collided. Then the night was filled with another kind of screeching, and I scrambled back, melting into the shadows, afraid of the shadows, but more afraid to turn my lights on, because the second of my questions was being answered. No, the Unseelie had not yet been freed from their prison. They were coming now, galloping down on a dark wind blowing from the horizon that had substance, the stuff of nightmares, led by death, pestilence, famine, and war. They came. I watched them come. The ones who have no names, the abominations, those who are flawed yet live, those who hunger yet can never be sated, those who hate eternally, who need beyond bearing with their twisted limbs and psychopathic dreams, those who know but one joy, the hunt, the kill, the nectar of dust and ashes. They soared over my head, high above the city, a vast dark wave that stretched from one end of the horizon to the other, obliterating the sky, shrieking, howling, trumpeting their victory, free, 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 for the first time in nearly a million years, free in a world warmed by sun, populated by billions of strong hearts beating, exploding with life, bursting with sex and drugs and music and glories untold that had been forbidden to them forever. They came, the wild hunt, the winged ones, carrying their brethren in beaks and claws and other things that defied description, streaming from their icy hell, icing the world a slippery, shining, silvery frost in their wake. I retreated into the belfry, my breath crystallizing on the bitterly cold air. Then I retreated even farther, slinking to the lower platform, where I crept to the broom closet, pushed my way in between mops and pails, and shut the door. Fingers numbed by cold, I shredded my T-shirt in the wan glow of one clicket, stuffed pieces of it into every potentially telltale nook and cranny, then clicked myself on from head to toe until I filled the tiny room with light. Heart pounding, eyes wide with terror, I backed into a corner, drew my knees to my chin, laid my spear harness on the floor beside me, and began the long vigil to dawn. Part 3. Dawn. Turned out I was wrong. It wasn't the dark I should have been afraid of at all. Max Journal. Chapter 19. It was the second longest night of my life. The longest is yet to come. I passed the time culling my memory for good ones, reliving them in vivid detail. Those 2 years when Alina and I were in high school together, the trip we'd made as a family to Tybee Island, the guy I'd met there, who gave me my first real kiss, out in the waves where my parents couldn't see us, my graduation party, Alina's farewell bash before she'd left for Ireland. Silence came long before dawn. It was absolute. The hours from 5 to 7 were so unearthly quiet I was afraid some cosmic calamity had befallen my closet, that a fey realm had been victorious in the battle for the right to exist at my precise latitude and longitude, and me and the mops had been relegated elsewhere. Precisely where elsewhere might be, I had no idea. But at 7:25 a.m., the moment of sunrise, it was still so utterly silent that when I placed my hand on the doorknob, it occurred to me to wonder if I might open it onto the vacuum of space. It would certainly simplify things. I would be dead, and no longer have to worry about what the day might bring. If I opened the door, I had to go out there. I didn't want to. My closet was cozy, safe, perhaps forgotten. What would I find out there? How would I get out of the city? What existed beyond Dublin's boundaries? Had we lost parts of the world last night in a metaphysical battle between realms? Was Ashford, Georgia, still where it was supposed to be? Was I? Where would I go? Who would I trust? In the grand scheme of things, finding the she-sadoo suddenly seemed a minor issue. I cracked open the door, glimpsed the lower platform beyond, and exhaled with relief. Distastefully, with meticulous care, I strapped my spear harness back on. Unseelie marched through my blood, posturing aggressively. It would continue to do so for days, and I would fear my spear the entire time. I eased from the closet. After a thorough look around to make sure no shades had assumed squatting rights during the night, I clicked myself off and ascended to the belfry. When I stepped into the stone archway, I exhaled another sigh of relief. The city looked mostly the same. The buildings stood. They hadn't been burned or demolished, and they hadn't vanished. Dublin might be worse for the wear, her party dress torn, hose run, stiletto heels broken, but she was in dishabille, not dead, and could one day be crack-filled and vibrant again. There was no foot or motor traffic. The city looked abandoned, though signs of rioting littered the streets, from cars to debris to bodies. There were neither people nor fae moving around down there. I felt like the last person left alive. There were no lights on, either. I checked my cell phone. No service. By nightfall, I was going to have to be holed up safely again. I watched the city until day had fully dawned, and sunlight splintered off streets cobbled with broken glass. In the past 45 minutes, no one and nothing had moved. It seemed the unseelie foot soldiers had scrubbed Dublin clean of human life and moved on. I doubted the shades had gone. I could see greenery on the outskirts of the city. They'd probably gorged until the first rays of morning had forced them to retreat to their hidden cracks and crevices. I blessed whatever fates had inspired me to make my Mac Halo. It looked like it was going to be an integral part of keeping myself alive for a while. Impossible to stay to the lights when there were no lights to stay to. First on my agenda was to find batteries and cram my backpack full of them. Second was food. Third was wondering if Barons could still track me by the tattoo at the base of my skull in a world that had merged with fairy realms, and if that was a good thing or a bad thing. Would Vlaine come searching for me? Had the She-Seer survived? How was Danny? I didn't dare let my thoughts turn toward home. Until I found a phone that worked and could call, I couldn't handicap myself with those fears. At the top of the rickety ladder, I slipped off my spear harness and dropped it 100+ feet to the floor below, tossing it into the corner near the door. If the rungs gave way again, I would not fall on my own spear. I descended slowly, carefully, and didn't breathe normally again until I'd reached the bottom. I'd eaten all the unseelie I'd diced and jarred, I felt safer with a stash on me. I wanted more, needed more. Who knew what battles I might encounter today? I grabbed a loop of the spear harness, slid it over my shoulder, and stepped through the door, head cocked, listening for voices, movement, any sign of danger. The church was eerily quiet, flatly so. I inhaled, taking full advantage of my unseelie enhanced senses. There was a peculiar odor in the air, one I couldn't place. It appealed, yet disturbed me. It smelled kindred, but not quite. I hated not having my she-seer senses. I hated not knowing if there might be Fay right around the corner, waiting to ambush me. I moved furtively forward and added a fourth note to my mental agenda. New footwear. Tennis shoes. Rare are the boots crafted for stealth, and mine weren't. Midway across the anteroom, I stopped. To my left was a wide flight of marble stairs, swathed by a carpeted runner that descended to tall double doors exiting the church. To my right was the entrance to the chapel. Even beyond its closed doors, I could smell the inner sanctum, the faint, cloying scent of incense, and that other elusive, spicy scent that disturbed and intrigued me. In the dim light of the hushed morning, the white doors of the oratory seemed to glow with a soft, unspoken invitation. I could turn left and head out into Dublin streets, or go right and take a few moments to confer with a god I'd not spoken to much in my life. Was he listening today? Or had he shaken his head, packed up his creation kit, and headed off for a less screwed-up world late last night? What would I talk about? How cheated I felt by Alina's death? How angry I was at being alone? I turned left. There were easier monsters to deal with in the streets. At the top of the stair, lust blasted me, incinerated my will, awakening exotic, excruciating sexual need. For a change, I welcomed it. "Vlaine!" I exclaimed, yanking my hand from the top button of my jeans. I could feel him outside the church. He was moving toward me, down the sidewalk, up the outer stairs, about to enter. He'd found me. I caught myself thanking the god I'd just refused to talk to. The doors opened, and I was blinded by sunlight. My pupils constricted to pinpoints. Framed in the entrance, Blaine's hair shimmered a dozen shades of gold, bronze, and copper. He looked every inch the avenging angel in a way barons never could. There was that unusual scent, the one that beckoned and bedeviled me, rolling off his skin. Did he always smell this way, and I could only pick it up now because I had unseelie heightened senses? Spiked by his dark brethren, I wasn't sensing Blaine as a fey. I felt no nausea. His appearance had been preceded only by his lethal sexuality. He was impacting me as he would any woman. It was no wonder heads turned when we went places. His allure was even stronger with my she-seer senses dead, as if some special quality in my blood normally shielded me from his full effect, but couldn't when my veins ran with fey. Whatever the reason, his impact was formidable today. It was even more intense than the first time I'd encountered him, when I'd had no idea what he was. My legs felt weak, my breasts were heavy, aching, and my nipples burned. I wanted sex, needed sex, violently. Had to have it, didn't care about repercussions. I wanted to fuck and fuck until I couldn't move. Hadn't he said he could give it to me without hurting me? Mute himself? Protect me from being harmed or changed? Turn it off, I forced myself to say, but I was smiling when I said it, and my command lacked heat. I was so relieved to see him. My sweater was on the floor. I bent to pick it up. He moved from the shaft of brilliant light and glided up the stairs.
"She is here,"
he said. As the door closed behind him and the anteroom returned to its dimly lit state, my pupils dilated, adjusted, and I realized my error. Gasping, I took a step back. "You're not Blaine." The exotic prince's gaze fixed on my breasts, sculpted by a lacy bra. I pressed my sweater to my chest. He made a sound deep in his throat, and my knees buckled with sexual anticipation. Only with immense effort did I remain standing. I wanted to be on my knees. I should be on my knees. He wanted me on my knees and hands. My head was vacuumed of thought. My lips and legs moved apart. He stepped closer. I fought a frantic battle with myself, managed to step back.
No, he said, I am not.
Lids lowered over alien ancient eyes, lifted.
Whatever that is.
Who are you? I stammered. He took another step forward. I took another step back. There went my sweater again. Shit.
The end, he said simply.
The doors leading to the inner sanctum opened behind me. I felt the draft of passage, and more of the strange, disturbing scent filled my nostrils. Lust sledgehammered me, front and rear.
We are all the end.
A cold voice floated over my shoulder.
And beginning. Soon. Later. After. Time?
Irrelevant, the other replied.
Round is round. We are always. You are not.
They might as well have been speaking a foreign language. I turned, hardly able to breathe. There was a lacy bra lying on the floor at my feet. It was mine. Shit, again. The air was cool on my flushed skin. I would not ask, after what? There were two of them. Two death by sex fae. Two princes. Could I outrun them? Could I survive them? They could sift. I was between them. Could I null them? Oh, God, not with my she-seer abilities dead. Do you know Vlaine? He's a silly prince. I managed to get out through lips that ached for touch, for fullness that had been only hinted at by the sensation of Vlaine's name piercing my tongue. I wanted to drown in men. I wanted to be stuffed plumper than a sausage. Lips would do. So would other things. I looked from one of their crotches to the next. I shook my head violently. My mouth was parched, my head spinning. He protects me. Maybe they were friends of his. Maybe they could summon him. Maybe they feared him and would back off. I wouldn't have been surprised by villainous laughs, sneers, ribald comments. After all, I was standing there naked from the waist up. I expected some comment, some expression, any expression. But they merely rotated their heads on their necks with eerie smoothness and examined me in a manner so far from human that my blood ran cold and I stopped breathing. I knew who they were. They were no friends of Lane's. That alien gesture had given them away. When I breathed again, it was a great sucking inhalation. These were the unseelie princes, fae that had never had the opportunity to study us, learn our habits, perfect glamour through mimicry. They that could employ our language but only void of reference or metaphor. That had learned about our world from a great distance by proxy. That probably didn't even grasp the basic fae concepts of stasis and change. They that had never been free, never drunk from the cauldron, never had sex with a human woman. But they planned to have sex with me. It was pouring off them in immense, hungry, dark waves. Lust laced the room, explosive as dynamite, its fuse dangerously short. The air reeked of it. I was drawing it in with every breath, feeding an unquenchable, exquisite fey fever. A third one glided into the church. What had Christian said? Myth equates the heads of those four houses, the dark princes, with the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Pestilence joined death and famine in God's house. Now only war remained unaccounted for. I hoped he would stay that way. They closed in on me, a circle of three, morphing from one shape to the next as they came. Shifting shapes, colors, and something else that might have been a dimensional nature. I see 3D, not 4 or 5. My eyes couldn't explain to my brain what they were seeing, so they just settled for pretending they weren't seeing it. Vlaine said the Fae had never revealed their true face to us. That may have been what I glimpsed. Swallowing my fear of the only weapon I had to use against them, I jerked out the spear, dropped the harness, and pivoted in a threatening circle. Stay back, I commanded. This is a Seelie Hollow. It can kill even princes. Just try me. I stabbed at the nearest one. He paused, regarded the spear, then raised incandescent eyes to mine. He swiveled his head upon his neck and glanced at the others, then back at the spear in a way that made me look too. I discovered with horror that my hand was turning it toward me, slowly, slowly, until the tip, the deadly flesh-rotting tip, was pointing straight at me. I tried to turn it away, to point it at him, but I couldn't move. My brain was issuing orders my body refused to obey. Rape was horrific enough. There was no way I was going to die like Malouche afterwards. When the tip was a mere quarter inch from my skin, I tried to fling the spear away, hoping I could, and they'd just forget about it. My release mechanism worked as my override had not, a thing that would make sense to me one day. And the spear clattered across the floor, through the door, into the chapel. It crashed into the base of the pedestal of holy water with such impact that water sloshed over the side and hissed and steamed when it hit the spear. The princes adopted static form, became males so unutterably beautiful that looking at them was a moment of such exquisite perfection that it hurt my soul, and I gibbered wordlessly. They were naked except for glistening black torques that writhed like liquid darkness around their necks. Their supple, golden-skinned bodies were tattooed in brilliant, complicated patterns that rushed over their skin, kaleidoscopic storm clouds across a gilded sky. Lightning flashed in their glittering eyes. Deep within me, I felt answering thunder. I couldn't look at them. They were too much. I turned away, but they were there again, forcing me to gaze upon their frightening, fantastic faces. My eyes widened, widened still. I wept tears of blood that scaled my cheeks. I scrubbed at them with my fingers, and they came away seared, crimson. Then the prince's mouths were on my fingertips, with tongues of soothing coolness and fangs of licking ice, and a beast far more primitive than Savage Mac and far beyond my control yawned and stretched her arms above her head and awakened with a delicious sense of anticipation. This was what she'd been born for, what she'd been waiting for all this time. Here, now, them. Sex that was worth dying for. I kicked off my boots. They peeled away my jeans and underwear and turned me between them, kissing, tasting, licking, taking, feeding from the passion they fed in me, slamming it back at me, taking it, returning it again, and with each transfer between us it grew into something bigger than me, bigger than them, into a beast of its own. With some distant part of my mind I recognized the horror of what was happening to me. I tasted on their perfect lips the emptiness within them, and understood that beneath the flawless, velvety golden skin, far beneath the waves of Eros I was drowning in, there was nothing but an ocean of me. I glimpsed, even as I surrendered to it, the true nature of the unseelie princes. They are voids of what they are not, and crave most. Passion, desire, the fire of life, the capacity to feel. Some essential component in them had been lost long ago, or perhaps frozen out of them by 700,000 years of icy incarceration, or perhaps they'd come into being via the king's imperfect song, equally imperfect and empty. Whatever the cause, the most intensely they could feel was through sex. They were maestros of lust, eternally denied music in their realm, surrounded by others also void, without a human's body to play the melody upon. But with a human, so long as she felt, so did they, and they would gorge on her song, until the concert hall fell silent, the passion turned to ash, and she died, her body gone as cold as that place inside them where life could never be fully realized. Empty, they would find another woman to play, and gorge again, giving her sex at its most elemental, at its purest and most potent, channeling all that it was to be alive out of her, back into her and out again. My orgasms were not petite mal, but repeated births, a recreation of myself every time I came. It was sex that was life, that was blood, that was God, that filled every empty orifice I had, inside and out. And it was killing me. And I knew it. And I had to have more. We rolled and slid across the cool marble floor of the anteroom, my three dark princes and I, seeking purchase on the carpeted stairs, one beneath me, one behind, one inside my mouth. They moved deep in me, filling me with sensations as kaleidoscopic as their tattooed bodies. I narrowed to a tiny blossom, exploded outward, and fragmented again and again into bits of shattered woman. They tasted of nectar, smelled of dark, drugging spices. Their bodies were hard and sculpted and perfect, and if every now and then the ice of their black torques and pink tongues and white teeth were sharp nips of frostbite at my skin, it was a small price to pay for what they did inside me. I felt my mind slipping. Moments of my life flashed before my eyes, before dropping away to some forsaken place. I cried out, begging to be freed, but my mouth shaped only words of instruction and demand. More, harder, faster, there! My last month in Dublin, with all its hopes and worries and fears, flashed through my mind and was forgotten. There went the day I'd spent in Ferry with Alina, followed by all memory of Malouche and Christian and the O'Banions and Fiona and Barons and meeting Rowena in the bar that first night in Ireland. My summer was flying backward past my eyes, falling away. Was there a fourth male kissing me now, tasting me? Why couldn't I see him? Who was he? I pricked myself on the day of Alina's death. Then it was gone, too, and that day hadn't happened, and my life continued to unfurl backward. I lost my college years to pestilence's kisses, a bad farewell to high school with famine spurting sweetly in my mouth. I lost my childhood in three fey princes' arms. If there was a fourth, I never saw his face, only felt the strangeness of another, who wasn't quite the same. And then I'd never been born. I was only now. This moment, this orgasm, this hunger, this endless emptiness, this mindless need. I was aware that others had entered the anteroom, but I could not see beyond my dark princes. Didn't care. More was good. When my princes drew away from me, my body grew so cold I thought I would die. I writhed on the floor, begging for more. Someone reached for me. I grasped with both hands for the succor of touch, tossed a tangle of hair from my eyes, and looked up, straight into the face of the Lord Master.
"I think she'll obey me now," he murmured.
"Obey him? I'd die for him." A note to the listener. I foreshadowed this moment, as I foreshadowed what's yet to come, but for those of you with flashlights running low on batteries, who feel the shades closing in and fear there's no hope in sight, consider this. In Blood Fever, Max says, "Although it may not seem like it, this isn't a story about darkness. It's about light." Khalil Gibran says, "Your joy can fill you only as deeply as your sorrow has carved you." If you've never tasted bitterness, sweet is just another pleasant flavor on your tongue. One day I'm going to hold a lot of joy. And she will. That was my promise in her words. For the latest news on Mac, future release dates and the like, drop by www.karenmonning.com or www.shesearsinc.com. The latter is an interactive website with hidden links, so you might have to do a little searching, but it's well worth it. My web designers are wonderfully talented, with a great sense of fun. You'll find a game to play, Mac versus the Shades, Fever World music downloads, Mac's Complete until the next Fever installment, Glossary, The Wall, The Map Room, and much, much more. At www.karenmonning.com, you'll find a fantastic message board community where I sometimes drop in. Stay to the lights. Karen. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Fey Fever by Karen Marie Monning. Copyright 2008, Karen Marie Monning. Read by Joyce Bean. Directed by Stephen Helderman. Engineered by Kevin Klempel. Performance copyright 2008, Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.